Hello and welcome to the podcast, Byzantium and Friends. I hope you're enjoying the spring weather, or summer weather, depending on where you are. I want to tell you one of the most extraordinary stories that I've come across in the sources that I read for the history of the Eastern Roman Empire. And this comes from a French text by one of the minor knights who were involved in the Fourth Crusade. This is Robert de Clary. And he tells a story. This is set in probably late 1203. And this is the moment when the Crusaders had managed to bully their way into the city and install their puppet Alexius IV, Angelos, on the throne and bring back his blinded father, Isaakios. And the Crusaders at this point have very much power and influence over the court. This is before things went south in the following year in 1204, which led to the destruction of the city. So one of the barons reported the following story, that he and some of his friends went to the palace to see Isaac and the emperor. And while they were in the palace, a king came there whose skin was all black, and he had a cross in the middle of his forehead that had been made with a hot iron. And this king was living in a very rich monastery in the city, which the former emperor, Alexius III, so this is Alexius III Komnenos, or we call him Angelos, that emperor had commanded that he should be lodged in that monastery, and he was to be the lord and owner so long as he wanted to stay there. And so the emperor saw him and rose to meet him and did honor to him, and the emperor asked the barons, "Do you know who this is?" And they said, "We do not know who this is." And he says, "This is the king of Nubia, who came on a pilgrimage to this city." And they brought out an interpreter, and they had a conversation with him, and he said that he had gone on this long pilgrimage from his land, which was something like 100 days travel south of Jerusalem, and he had gone to Jerusalem and then to Constantinople, and he hoped to go on to Rome and possibly Spain and then return to Jerusalem and live out his days there. This is an extraordinary story, all the more so for the fact that we do not hear anything about this. This tradition of Nubian pilgrimage to Constantinople in any Constantinopolitan source. Our Greek sources are completely silent about this aspect of their culture, but the Emperor Alexius III seemed to have been quite familiar with this relationship, so much so that when this, quote, king of Nubia, that could be any position really of prominence in Nubia, showed up, he was quite willing to grant him a monastery for him to stay in as an honored guest in Constantinople. I had puzzled over this story when I was writing a book on Byzantine ethnography a long time ago, in part because the sheer silence of the Greek sources on these kinds of relationships was a little bit frustrating and kind of baffling. Why would Constantinopolitans not want to talk about the great reach and fame of their city, such that kings of Nubia came on pilgrimage to it? Of course, if you think about it, these East Roman authors do not talk very much about foreign people, even foreign people who espoused a similar version of Christianity to them, like Orthodoxy. And we know that Orthodoxy, that is Constantinopolitan Orthodoxy, had a very strong presence in Nubia and many other places outside the empire. Yet this is something that is not talked about much in the Greek sources. This is, in fact, a general phenomenon. East Roman sources also don't talk about the Rus, or later Russians, very much, though we know that many of them were going on pilgrimage to Constantinople, and in fact, we have quite a few of their texts that have been edited and published and translated and very much discussed. In the 14th century, there are writers in Constantinople who are writing about Muscovy or Russia. They don't know very much about it. They make incredible mistakes, and you'd think they'd know more. But this general pattern of silence persists. Silence, or perhaps indifference, but in modern times, the balance of attention that we've given to these two sides, north and south, to put it very schematically, is strikingly unbalanced. So a tremendous amount of attention has been paid to the, quote, Byzantine Commonwealth, defined as the lines of orthodoxy that linked Byzantium to Slavic Orthodox people. I'm referring here to Dmytro Bolensky's famous book, The Byzantine Commonwealth, and very, very little attention has been paid to a very similar commonwealth that extended toward the south into lands that had, in the distant past, been part of the empire, so northern Africa, including Egypt, but also places further south where Christianity had spread from those late Roman provinces in North Africa, and along with it had traveled a pretty vast repertoire of artistic themes and media and styles and book learning, and also language. Greek outside of the empire, of course, remained a very important lingua franca in some contexts, both in Africa and in the Middle East. And what's interesting is that this repertoire of styles and media acquired a life of its own in those lands. It was not dependent on a continual reinforcement from the, quote, center, if you want to take Constantinople as a kind of center, but it had its own life in those lands, but remained an axis of communication and affinity between, say, kings of Nubia and emperors in Constantinople as late as the 1200. So we are now in the wonderful position of not having to puzzle over these connections or try to tease them out by exploring lots and lots of different areas of academic research that are not often very coordinated, not as they are in kind of the Eastern European Byzantine axis. And this is because of an exhibition that was put on at the Met in New York, which is by now very famous and perhaps requires little introduction, but I should introduce it nonetheless. It is called Africa and Byzantium, and was at the Met for some time. It is now in Cleveland, where you can still go see it until, I think, mid-July. The information is given by my guest in the interview. That guest is Andrea Myers-Achi, who organized the exhibition at the Met and is the Byzantine curator there. She also edited the fantastic catalog volume, the exhibition volume, also called Africa and Byzantium, which I have read very carefully twice because the material in here is spectacular. And there's some 40 papers. And I should also say, and we talk about this in the in our discussion, that just how many people are involved in putting together such an exhibition. It is a huge organizational and logistical challenge. And so kudos to Andrea for pulling it off in such a spectacular fashion. She talks about her background in the first part of our discussion, so I won't talk about that here. But if you're interested in understanding this relationship between a king of Nubia and an emperor of Constantinople, I strongly encourage you to at least get the volume and look through the images that bring this world to life and the essays that explain all of that wonderful material. But also, if you happen to be near Cleveland until some point in mid-July, definitely head out there and check it out at the Cleveland Museum of Art. So, thanks to medievalist.net for reposting these episodes. And without any further delay, here is my conversation with Andrea. Andrea, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we talk about the exhibition, can you tell us first a little bit about your academic background? Where are you coming to this project from?
Yes, I actually started off as an archaeologist. I had a whole previous life working in Egypt and in the Western Desert, but then also in monastic sites along the Nile Valley, such as in I did a project with Stephen Davis at the White Monastery. And when I was an undergrad, I actually thought I was going to either be a classics professor, and I could do Greek or be a full-on archaeologist. And then I would go back and forth between Egypt and my graduate studies at NYU for years. And when I was thinking about a dissertation topic, I realized that I didn't really necessarily want to continue to go back and forth to Egypt and the United States. And so I was really looking for materials that pulled together a lot of my research interests. And so I decided to write a dissertation on Coptic manuscripts at the Morgan Library. And I basically did an art historical analysis of 47 manuscripts at the Morgan that were made and used at a monastery in Egypt called the St. Michael's Monastery. And so, and I mean, it's very interesting how I think all Byzantinists kind of came into the field in different ways. But I've been thinking about Egyptian materials really deeply in a lot of different disciplines, from archaeology, but then also textual materials and now art history. And actually, when I was getting my PhD in Byzantine art history at the Institute of Fine Arts at NYU with Thelma Thomas, I didn't really see myself in the museum space, really. I actually was on more or less the academic job market, but I was also working for Helen Evans as an intern in the medieval department, cataloging archaeological materials that were really similar to the materials that I worked on in Egypt. So, 4th or 7th century potteries and ostraca from the Karger Oasis. And I started that internship in at the end of 2013, and I just stayed in my desk for years. And when I was finishing up my PhD, Helen told me about the position of assistant curator within a department. And I actually told her, I was like, oh, well, I'm not qualified for that. Like, I'm not going to apply. And she was like, well, why don't you just apply for this and see maybe how your research interest really fits within the Met's collection. And it was just really inspiring to get that push. And so that's really a long story of how I got from, you know, sitting looking at dusty pots in Egypt to being the Byzantine curator at the Met.
So you see me smiling here because you've mentioned some names that take me back. So Thelma used to be at Michigan when I was there, when I was a grad student. And for quite a few years, my advisor, John Fine, who's a Balkan historian, he would have a sort of a round table every Thursday or Friday at this Greek bar. And just we would all just show up and talk about, you know, Balkan, Byzantine history or whatever. And Thelma would show up too. But for me, it was just a great exposure to people coming from all these different, Byzantine field, whatever that is, right? And there's a Balkan historian in Thelma who worked on Egypt and textiles. And especially about Egypt, like especially the way you described it right now, it's this whole world in itself, right? With the archaeology and the Coptic, and you have things like textiles and people's shoes and sometimes their bodies. And anyway, right? And you can get lost in it. I mean, you can just, you know, completely devote yourself to that world. No, I can totally see how you, the trajectory that you followed. After all, it's not like there's a real sort of academic to curatorial pipeline that's very well defined, right?
Well, absolutely. And I think that with Byzantine art history, it's really important to be interdisciplinary, right? Like you need the languages, and we're so object-based. And so the fact that I have the archaeological background, it's really helped me in my curatorial practice and the ways in which I look at the objects in my purview and here at the Met. And I think also because there's not a lot of jobs in the field, right? And so when I was in graduate school, I was thinking, like, how can I continue to do this work that's really interests me overall, and I'm really passionate about it, especially the topic, no matter what job that I get. And so throughout graduate school, I was continuing going on sites, but then also working in museums, and then also teaching myself digital humanities, and just doing everything so I could continue to work in this field despite what the job market might have looked like when I graduated. And I think that my peers in art history, like Betsy Williams and Elizabeth O'Connell at the British Museum, Maximilian Durand, we all, like within graduate school, did so much. And like we weren't really thinking, like, okay, we're going to be a curator at XYZ institution, right? And I think that that has helped us really look at objects in an interdisciplinary way.
Yeah, and it comes through in the exhibition and the catalog. I mean, you've got everything from what most of the audience would expect from art history, but also manuscripts and papyri and inscriptions and all of this. And I think that richness of exposure is really necessary. And I think your background has prepared you excellently for that. So most of my guests are like professors at universities. and I'm sure the audience knows more or less what they do. Can you tell us a little bit about what your job at the Met is? Like, what are your curatorial functions apart from organizing these exhibitions, which are major, major projects? But other than that, what do you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Last year, I was appointed to the Mary and Michael J. Harris Associate Curator position of Byzantine Art. And so this is a position that Helen Nevins had from 1997 until 2020. And so big shoes to fill. And within that role, I have within my curator purview objects from the Eastern Mediterranean from the 4th to the 15th century, broadly. But there's some materials within the medieval department that are archaeological that date before the 4th century that are in my galleries. And then there's also materials under my purview, such as Ethiopian crosses that date after the 15th century. And so it's a really interesting position because it ingrains Byzantium within the Met because it's also a title, right? That's like for Byzantine art. And so everything under my purview, like we as a Met curator, I curate within either the restraints, for a lack of better word, of Byzantium. So that's one thing that I do. And in terms of curate, what does that mean? So a curator cares for material, right? In terms of thinking about cura. And I go through the object files and update bibliographies, thinking about the conservation, thinking about page turns within the galleries, right? I'm consistently thinking about the narratives that we tell within the galleries themselves and how do we present this material in a way in which a 5th grader from Brooklyn who comes into the galleries will understand what Byzantium is. But then also a scholar like you, if you come into the galleries, you won't be so turned off by the didactic material that you're like, this is elementary, right? And then that's really difficult because we have such a big range of visitors coming into the galleries looking at the permanent collections. I consistently do smaller exhibitions in a space called the Byzantine Crypt. And this is a space under this, the stairs of the Met, and it's specifically Byzantine Egyptian material, but there's other archaeological material in that space. It's a really exciting space because the types of materials that we put in there is they're very light sensitive. And so we have to consistently rotate materials, such as textiles, but then also papyri, for example, in that space. And so I have a list of exhibitions from like now to 2032 of different projects that I'm doing in that space. And then I also like to keep my foot in academia as well and continue to collaborate with scholars on materials under my purview at the Met, but then also at other museums as well. And that's really gratifying to continue to go to conferences and give lectures about Byzantine art. And so I'm certainly busy.
Yeah, and I imagine that you must also be doing continual research on the objects that you have there and everything published about them, and just to update the information on how you present it. And I am very appreciative of what museums have done in recent decades to make that information more available, because I started touring museums sort of systematically in the 90s, and especially like in Greece and Europe. And it was just like a little label, paper label that they'd written some very general description in French, and that's what you got.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a really exciting time for Byzantine art history in museums. Like the projects that my colleagues are doing, like I feel like we're all kind of aligned and trying to allow the general public to rethink what Byzantium is. And what the Louvre is doing right now, for example, is so exciting. And then their new Byzantine department that's opening in 2027, the projects that Bessie Williams has been doing, it, and I feel like this is, even though I have this Africa Byzantium project, it really aligns with what's happening in the field overall, but then also builds on so much of the work of previous Byzantine curators. And it's really exciting to me. And to your point about updating object files, one of my goals for 2023 and 2025 is actually to read all the object files in the Byzantine collection at the Met. I have about 7,000 objects under my purview. And, there's some objects that the files haven't been updated. And I do know that scholars are working on these materials and thinking about them differently. And so even that process of updating the bibliographies and, really formalizing inserting the new scholarship within our own files has been really important to me.
Okay, so let's talk about this exhibition a little bit. A moment ago, you mentioned that Helen's shoes are, kind of large to fill. But also, the Met has a history of putting on some pretty blockbuster exhibitions on Byzantium that have been very successful. And it must have been pretty daunting to try to, do your own. And it's been a resounding success. So congratulations on that. I mean, that this is
Thank you.
really, really impressive. And I think you've brought not only new aspects to the public, but also, continue to extend the reach and significance of Byzantium for us. So how did you conceive this exhibition differently from the other ones that the Met has put on, but in the tradition?
The exhibition, in many respects, came out of my dissertation project on Coptic manuscripts. So when I was finishing my dissertation, I actually told them, why don't I just write a chapter about the connections between book producers in Egypt and the book producers along the Nile Valley from Egypt to Ethiopia. And she said, you know what, you need to just finish your dissertation and then maybe you can do an exhibition on this later. And so when I started at the Met, that's really what I wanted to do, is think about book production in Northern Africa and the connections between bookmakers. And that idea expanded in so many ways, because one early advice I received was that the books that are coming from these regions, we can't do an exhibition on that. You need to bring in lots of different materials. And so that's how I was really looking at this project as like the material culture of these Northern African regions. And that's why we have the textiles and the ostraca and papyri, but then also great icons in the project, just so people can get a sense of that material culture. The original project was really actually supposed to be focused on the 4th to 7th century, when Northern Africa was a part of the Byzantine world, and such an important part overall. And then the project just kept getting bigger. And also, the original project was conceived as a smaller project. But then when I pitched it to the director of the Met, he was like, well, this is actually aligns with the types of exhibitions that the Met's been doing, like, and really changing the ways in which people are thinking about Byzantium. I mean, we have Gloria Byzantium, right? And that included Armenian art and Coptic art and art from like the peripheries. And then Faith and Power also had art from like what people would consider not to be Constantinopolitan work. And so in many ways, those exhibitions provided space for Africa Byzantium exhibition, because the Met already was primed to be thinking about Ethiopian art in a relationship to Byzantine art, or even Coptic art as well. It was actually quite interesting rereading those catalogs in preparation for this exhibition, because you see, like with Gloria Byzantium, Thelma Thomas contributed to it. There were so many people who were assistant professors at that time, right? And then we had these chapters about these topics that came into Africa Byzantium. But then also, even thinking about the age of spirituality, right? And there's so many works that I put into Africa Byzantium that was also an age of spirituality, like the Cleveland textile next to the Sinai icon. Sinai icon didn't come in 1977, but they had a reproduction of it in the age of spirituality, right? And so it was also interesting, as I was developing the project, to think about the ways in which this idea has changed over the time period of our field, right, in terms of these connections between Northern Africa and Byzantium. And these ideas were coming out of my dissertation itself, but I was still looking back and using these objects that scholars are familiar with overall.
There's a fascinating drift, that happens with especially late antique Egypt, was that ancient historians at some point they all realize that there's just much more evidence in the later period, and this is why you start to get Roman historians that sooner or later will become late Roman historians. And when they're in that field, then they realize that, well, most of the evidence is from Egypt, and that we just have such extraordinary richness of material and from the papyri and the textiles and everything. And so then you have to enter into this world of Coptic manuscripts. So, but there's this inevitable dynamic and drift that brings people to this world. And as you said, there was a period when it was actually part of the Roman Empire, but it has so many strands and connections in terms of artistic themes and so forth to parts of the world outside the empire, but also even after the Islamic conquest. So there's this kind of an abiding resilient connections here. And yet, they haven't really been studied that much. And this part of the world hasn't been conceptualized very often in the way that you do in the exhibition and the catalog. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why you think that is. Other parts of Byzantine or East Roman cultural transmission, contact, or whatever you want to call it, have been studied, but this one, not so much until you pulled it all together here. So what's going on here?
That's a great question. And perhaps also for our listeners, I can kind of step back and give like the arc of the exhibition, because I don't think I've provided an introduction yet. But the exhibition is divided into three parts, right? And it focuses on the 4th and 7th century when Northern Africa was one of the centers of the Byzantine world, like cities such as Alexandria, but then also Carthage were intellectual, religious centers, artistic centers, and historians know this, right? So in Age of Spirituality, Kirk Weissman talks about these centers. And so I think this is really familiar with people who are working on late Roman history, late antiquity overall, even though the African context hasn't necessarily been privileged. Like this is just Rome, right? Like in part of the empire and a part of Mediterranean studies. And I think when people's looked at those early galleries with the Sinai icons and the beautiful jewelry and the painted panel paintings. These were all familiar to art historians. It wasn't necessarily surprising. I think it was the framing of this being African material culture was surprising to them. The second part of the exhibition, which focuses on the 8th to the 15th century, when Byzantium no longer had imperial control over the northern African regions. And there was this conversation about the connections between Christian religious communities along the Nile Valley and what we consider to be the Byzantine world. I think that that framing of the exhibition could be surprising because people study either, Coptic art through a silos, Ethiopian art history through this disciplinary silos, and even medieval Nubia. It's difficult to get your PhD in medieval Nubian art. And so I brought together these works of art that are familiar to some scholars of Byzantine art history or Western art history, but it's usually within like a footnotes or like older publications. And I just tried to bring all of that together, but then also recent scholarship on that material together and putting it into a conversation with Byzantine art history. And so that part of the exhibition was so exciting for me because the medieval Nubian frescoes are not only monumental, but they're really fascinating. I mean, the medieval Nubians were speaking Greek from the 4th century to the 15th century. That was one of the lingua francas, and there's so many really great texts that I brought into the exhibition that talked about these connections between the Nubians and the Byzantines. But then also I brought in texts of old Nubian material that's never been translated. And the reason why I wanted to bring in that was because I wanted, like, an intrepid graduate student to like, see something like that and say, like, okay, I want to get my PhD in this. And I've been often thinking about the legacies of these projects. And so, okay, so that was the second part of the exhibition. And the last part of the exhibition focused on the 15th century, generally, so early modern period to today, and thinking about the legacies of Byzantine art in Eastern African regions. And the reason why I wanted to end with Ethiopian material is because, again, there's people familiar with this material, but in terms of training in order to be a scholar in like Ethiopian art or Ethiopian icons, it's actually quite difficult. Like there's people getting a PhD in African art, right, and trained in that way, but writing a dissertation on Ethiopian textiles, for example, and there's people who are getting their PhDs in Byzantine art and working on Ethiopian material. And I just really wanted to bring all of those disciplinaries together within this the last part of the exhibition and think about that, what that really means in order to think about Ethiopian art in connection to the broader Orthodox world overall.
It really works. I mean, when you see it all laid out like this, you can see all of the common themes. That this is a kind of a world with its own, a koine, kind of a visual language and a set of themes that tend to recur. For me, this is not unknown. Every time I meet someone from Ethiopia, we can start talking about Orthodox and so on, which is an odd kind of connection to make, especially in an American context. I don't think most Americans sort of, or even Western Europeans understand that there is this line of either a current Orthodox, religious affiliation or in the past, like a part of a cultural template. But that's in part because of the way we've written history. So something like Aksum, this major, major kingdom, right? Like in its world, in its time, like between the fourth and, you know, sixth, seventh centuries. It was like one of four. There's Rome, Aksum, Himyar, and Persia. And they all knew it. They knew that these are the four powers, right? It's a very different, much more multipolar world than the earlier when we just had the Roman Empire and there are just some periphery, right? And yet, it's not like there's a discipline for Aksum studies. It kind of gets carved up and divided up into all of these different fields. And so it's sometimes difficult to put it all together in a coherent way and explain to the public what it was. Was it part of the goals that you had for this exhibition to do that and just kind of pull all of this together so that it begins to look more like a common world? And did you encounter anything surprising while you were doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. Well, for the exhibition and the catalog, I tried to bring in a lot of scholars who are working on this type of material. So for the catalog, I have 40 authors, and which I don't know if I would edit a catalog with that many people from different disciplines again, and getting all those essays in time for the publication. Like, I feel like this was also one of my accomplishments. But the reason why I wanted to do that was to show the field that there's a lot of people working on this material who are thinking about Aksum in a relationship with Byzantium, but also Aksum in relationship to Tunisia, right, during the 4th century. And like, they have lots of different questions and ideas about the future of these studies, but using, primary source texts and objects that are available and institutions to kind of flesh out these questions. And I see the catalog and the exhibitions, not necessarily the state of this field and the state of the question, but the possibilities of bringing all these types of materials together, and the possibilities of what a discipline of Northern and Eastern Africa in a longue durée might look like. I mean, it has to be interdisciplinary, right? And we need archaeologists and historians and art historians working together. But I was just trying to kind of providing a model of how that might work. And so we've had the catalog with the 40 authors, but then also there was a scholarly advisory committee that was international. One thing in your question, like what was surprising? Well, I started the exhibition project in 2018. And so many things have happened from 2018 to 2023, right? And one good thing about COVID actually was that the switch to virtual and being able to have these virtual conversations. So I was able to make my scholarly advisory committee even more international because we were able to switch the conversation to a Zoom conversation versus bringing people to New York City. And so that was kind of a happy, surprising thing that happened. So I was able to have advisors from Ethiopia and Tunisia and people who probably wouldn't have come to New York for a committee meeting about the exhibition. And then finally, I really tried to involve community members of these faith communities that are related to the exhibition and the development of the project as well. So thinking about the exhibition narrative, but then also the checklist itself. And so the objects that I have in the exhibition coming from like Ethiopia and Sudan and even Egypt, I had the different community members review them, right? So I could feel comfortable about the types of objects I'm bringing into the exhibition for provenance and cultural heritage issues, but then also this narrative that I'm trying to tell about the connections between Africa and Byzantium as well. So that's a long answer to your question, but shortly, it's just really the switch to Zoom that has allowed me to incorporate so many different voices.
I wanted to talk about the logistical aspects, but let's put that off for just a moment. Should I tell you what I found surprising? Not surprising in a sense that I wouldn't have expected this, but I never thought about the extent of it. There's this model of empire that is like the hub and spoke model, right? Where things radiate out from the hub and they just go, and the ends of the spokes don't really communicate with each other. They're just seen from the center. And we use this model implicitly or explicitly a lot. But this is not that model. This is much more of a rim. There's a kind of center, but it's much more of a rim where the different parts are all communicating with each other as well. And I was surprised to see the extent of that. Like all of these cultures take these this common language, this koine, and they run with it and they have contacts with each other about it. And Constantinople may or may not be there, and a lot of the times it's not. Like the material has achieved, escape velocity, we used to say in physics. It's just no longer tied to the gravity of a center.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing that I try to do in an exhibition is to show that the center is where you are, right? And so, like, people who were in Alexandria, they thought they were in the center. People in Axum, they thought they were in the center. But in many respects, that's how we live in the world today. Like, I live in New York City. I think I'm in the center of the world, right? And I'm sure you think that Chicago is. And so, I just think that, like, when you're living your life, right? And then, you know, and working and have your families, and even though you might like intellectually be engaging with colleagues in other cities, right? This is the way that some people thought about themselves during that time period. And that's actually one of the reasons why I had so many maps in the exhibition. I've been really inspired by mapping projects. Actually, there's this really great book by Elizabeth Alexander that she wrote in 2021 called The Trayvon Generation. And in the book, she said that maps are like monuments, and maps are not neutral, and every map expresses a point of view. And I was really inspired by this idea of maps expressing a point of view, because you can literally decenter people's perception based on the map in a certain space. And so that's the reason why I have, you know, these maps that show these different quote unquote centers that are different than what we think about, like Rome and Constantinople during this time period.
What's the connection with Trayvon?
Oh, it's called The Trayvon Generation, her book. And like, she really thinks about like this the generation of people who grew up during, like, right after Trayvon passed away. And so, like, she talks about mapping, monuments, art overall, intellectual making, and like in the ways in how we've been, institutions have created space for different kind of ambitious ideas and projects.
Let's talk about the individual cultures that are represented here. And orthodoxy is obviously one very important connecting thread, but there are others. Can you talk a little bit about some of the others?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think trade is a big thread, right? Like, in terms of the circulation of materials, that's the reason why I have the African red slipware from Northern Africa, but then also the jewelry as well. And then there's also in textiles, right, that were traded as well. There's pilgrimage, which connects to orthodoxy, but then also doesn't. Like, you have pilgrims from all over the world going to Sinai, even if they're not Greek Orthodox, right? And like, in being inspired by the icons at Sinai as well. There's painting practices and artistic heritage that circulates that doesn't necessarily connect to theological differences, right, between the different communities. And so, thinking about the painting practices of icons, but then also the practices of mosaic making that is throughout the Mediterranean, despite what religion you are. And so, like, I really try to talk about the shared artistic and visual traditions in these communities, despite the logical differences between a lot of the communities, right? There's forms, like the form of the book, that spreads from Egypt across the world, like after like the roll to the codex. And then I talk a little bit about that as well. And so I try to break down these boundaries, both in terms of geographic boundaries, but then also boundaries that we see from a disciplinary standpoint, right? Like, bringing in these different types of materials that these traditions shared.
There's some areas in which, from a Constantinopolitan standpoint, where the periphery actually prevails over the center. And I think icons might actually be one of those. There's a German scholar, Philipp Niewöhner, who's done some work on which areas of the Eastern Mediterranean were using icons in religious worship before iconoclasm. And obviously very much in Egypt and also in Italy, but not in Asia Minor. And he argues that just by looking at archaeological remains of churches and what they had and what they didn't have, that Asia Minor was much more of a cross venerating region, but that Egypt was much more, I mean, icons, religious imagery, and that essentially iconoclasm was the importation of that form of religious worship to Constantinople and Asia Minor as
Oh,
well.
that's fascinating.
It's a in a sense it's a pretty radical thesis, but this was surprising to me and to him also, that no one had seemed to study this regionally, right?
Oh,
But
that's
if
really
you,
fascinating.
it was almost a way of that Constantinople and Asia Minor catching up with the rest of the Christian world.
Oh, absolutely. And there's so many more. I mean, this is why I think are feels really exciting, right? Because even though we're working on pre-modern material, this is so much more that we can learn from it as well.
So another element that struck me was the continued role of the Greek language in this world, even after the Arab conquest of Egypt, when there's no, Greek administration or anything like that. Can you talk a little bit about the continued use of Greek as a sort of lingua franca? Maybe give some examples from the exhibition, like some of the striking objects or texts that you found.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we see it really in the exhibition for the two parts. One, and for the Coptic manuscripts, the colophons are in Greek, which is really interesting. And I talk about this in the exhibition catalog, where it was hard to really bring that out. And the exhibition itself, people couldn't turn the pages. But it's fascinating that the scribes are copying these liturgical manuscripts in Coptic. Right. And then at the end, they write their the dates and the names and their, anxieties in Greek. Right. And so and thinking about and that language connection. And then the other really interesting thing is the Nubian frescoes that we brought from the National Museum in Warsaw. They all have Greek inscriptions. And so these are monumental frescoes, about 8 feet tall. They have images of biblical figures such as Saint Peter, but then also contemporary Nubian figures, such as a Nubian named Bishop Petros. And we know the names of the figures through the inscriptions because it's in Greek, right? But it's fascinating because we also know the Nubians spoke their own indigenous language, called what we call Old Nubian. And so on one hand, they are writing, letters and different documentary materials in Old Nubian, but they're using Greek in their official letters and liturgical texts, but then also in the churches as well. And so, in many respects, Greek was very much an African language during this time period. And it's a language that the different Christian communities used to communicate with each other for thousands of years. And I think that's surprising to a lot of Greeks today. And they were surprised. They're like, oh, like there's so much Greek here, right? And I was like, yes, It's surprising to Byzantinists, I think, as well. I mean, even Ethiopians were speaking in Greek as well, and we have a Greek and Ethiopian texts that were translated from Greek texts as well. And I think that this is just one of the many universal languages during the medieval period.
I would love to have been able to speak with some of these. This is a kind of pet interest of mine. And for a long time, I don't think I'm ever going to do this, but I fantasize about doing it. To make a reader of Greek texts that are not from the Greek world,
Oh, yeah.
right? Like from antiquity in the Middle Ages, when it's being used by people, different culture whose, native language is different, but they use it for, whatever reasons, one might. There are all of these texts from inscriptions to official correspondence and whatever. I'm always struck by the fact that in the 13th century, the sultans of the Seljuks and Rum, when they were corresponding with the French Lusignan on Cyprus, they did so in Greek, because it's a sense the common language that it's not the primary language of either of them. Well, depending, who knows really what languages these people spoke.
No, and I mean, it's just so fascinating. And I think you should definitely do this reader. I think it would be really great. I just saw a manuscript at Christie's last week. It was a Greek manuscript that was made in Sicily in the 13th century. And it was just like really fascinating because I've been thinking about Byzantine text overall, but then like what that Greek gospel that's on the Western side, like what is it? Like where does it like really fit into, the ways that we're thinking about our field? And so I've been also thinking about, as you said, Greek beyond
Beyond.
these borders.
I mean, in Sicily, there were Greek-speaking communities until pretty late. I'm also intrigued by even the Franks, the French who conquer the Peloponnese within the 2 generations, they're speaking Greek and they're writing their texts in Greek. I sometimes wonder if they could even speak French anymore. But anyway, that's just a
Yeah.
whole other.
No, it's beyond Africa, Byzantium.
Absolutely. But a lot of these texts are from Africa. Even I know of some Hellenistic period texts. There was a historian, Afafarchidis, and he wrote about A king of what would it have been? Meroe would have been called before Aksum, right? And
Yeah, Mary. Yeah.
who used Greek in official correspondence, and he quotes this letter. And it was one of it was when I read that text that I thought I should really do a reader, because Greek should not just be associated with Greeks and native Greek speakers. Anyway, on that point, I noticed that a number of the contributors to the volume were kind of struggling with this tension between, like, well, what we call influence. That is, so the Byzantine
Yeah.
influence, which is a kind of very unidirectional and kind of there's an active passive way in which we think about it, but also highlighting local agency and kind of trying to break out of the center periphery polarity. It is a very difficult kind of balance to strike. There's this instinct to essentialize cultural traits as
Yeah.
belonging, right, to the originator culture, as it were. Assuming there ever was such a thing, because all cultures in the process of receiving things from the past and changing them, and who owns anything, right? But this is a real problem. So can you talk a little bit about this dynamic generally, or is it something that you had to confront explicitly when you were preparing this? Like, how not to, I don't know, like, make this all a diffusionist model from a prestige center?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And through the conversations with catalog contributors, but then also the scholarly advisory committee, we talked about the best way to address this because, the typical visitor to the Met, they have an idea of what Byzantium is, right? And that they, I mean, maybe they went to a previous Byzantine exhibition, but they have an idea of where the center is, right? Constantinople and what maybe art from that area looks like. And so I knew going into this project that I am challenging the visitor of what Byzantine art is, right? And I'm also saying that Byzantine art is also a 5th-century icon that's made in Egypt, right? Like this is also Byzantine art, right? And then expanding this definition, and so trying to negotiate expectations with facts, right? Like in terms of thinking about the purview of Byzantium, what's difficult. And I think that that's what you're seeing in terms of this tension, because everyone who vote for the catalog and the scholarly advisors, I mean, this is they're specialists in this field, but then also within their own work, they're navigating this within the broader field of Byzantine studies as well. But then on top of that, I think you're sensing a tension because of where we are within Byzantine studies and thinking about terms and terminology. And so different scholars are using different terms and thinking about medieval Roman or Byzantium or not using Byzantium as well. And so there's, I think that if this exhibition actually was done 15 years ago, you wouldn't have that kind of angst, right? And thinking about using Byzantium when literally in our field, we're figuring out, well, what does this mean? Like, what does this word itself means? And then even if this exhibition is was done, in 2035, like maybe we have already solved all those problems. And but because the exhibition is done in 2023, when there's this, question also about the word of Byzantium itself, and like, what do we mean? But then on top of that, we're providing, bringing in new material. I think that you get that sense within the catalog. Within the exhibition, I really tried, like in terms of the labels, I tried to kind of present some of these issues that we're having in our field within the labels by just presenting questions and without like saying, like, this is exactly what's happening. And like I said, these are things that we're thinking about. We don't have an answer for it. And just to provide that sense of uncertainty for the visitors. And I was really comfortable doing that.
Yeah, I have to say, since I'm at the heart of a discussion about what we call the civilization, at least in the more political sense that I work on,
Yeah.
I am thrilled to be made uncomfortable by perceptions of it, like yours, like what you've done here, which look at a different set of themes that challenge me to think also about these questions, because I have pretty settled views about these matters of identity when it comes to things like states and territoriality and citizenship and ethnicity and so on. And there's a level on which Byzantium, the Byzantines are very, very misleading and distorting terms. But that puts a burden on me to then think, Well, what would I call what you've done here? That right,
Yeah.
like, so what is the common axis here? How does this work? And in fact, in a sort of separate little essay that I'm writing, I've had to make a separate space for art history, especially precisely what you've done here, because what you've done here is not, this isn't Roman. I mean, that's a very
Yeah.
misleading term for what it is, or East Roman or anything like that. There are problems also with the term orthodoxy, and for
Yeah.
various reasons. Not all of this material is orthodox
Yeah.
either. And I was led to conclude that Byzantine can be used in art history, or without any objections from me at any rate.
Yeah.
And I'm not the sort of pope who granting permission here or anything like that. But
Yeah.
I'm just saying it can work as a descriptor for certain styles
Yeah.
or whatever that cross state, ethnic, linguistic boundaries,
Yeah.
right? Which is one way we can get rid of the word post-Byzantine, right?
Yeah.
If it matches the style, it's
Yeah.
right. Anyway, this is some thinking on my part because we do need to have words to describe this. By the way, have you wrestled with the sort of Byzantine Commonwealth kind of constructions? You know what I mean? So
Yeah.
is this a commonwealth of a sort? Is this an African Byzantine commonwealth?
Yeah, well, I think that the dates trip us up, right? Because it's how do we talk about Byzantium in Northern Africa after the 8th century, right? And so, and I think that using this word Byzantine as a definition for specific styles that I've been feeling comfortable with, and in the same point, ways in which that, with Roland Bredenkarte's work on the expanding this term Byzantium and his Exiles Byzantium was actually really inspiring to me as I was thinking through about parsing out these terms. Like if Byzantium means nothing, right? Like if it's like a distorting word and it means nothing, it could actually mean anything, right? We can like provide our own definitions of what Byzantine style might be. And so that's really what I'm working with. And I mean the same ways in which our colleagues in medieval studies broadly, like they have this term for this field that's a made-up term, right? But you have like the definitions for it. And so that's how I've been looking at Byzantium.
Because there isn't a contemporary term for it.
Yeah.
Like, my view is like, if you have a contemporary term for something, and it's used fairly consistently, and it maps on to the evidence that we have, use it.
Yeah.
But if you don't, for what you're doing here, whether we, by definition, we need to use a made-up term.
Yeah.
And I think this one can work. We'll see. Obviously, there'll be a big discussion. What did you say? 2035? Is that the date that you gave for when these issues will
Oh,
be resolved?
2035. Yeah. The
Okay, I'll
clock's
set.
ticking.
Yes, I'll set my watch. We'll see where we land, because I'm very skeptical of the kind of Slavic Orthodox Byzantine Commonwealth idea, which is the product of associating Byzantium with Eastern Europe and Russia, which was a mostly 19th and 20th century, Western European fixation. When Russia f seemed to fail in its kind of enlightenment project, which was the 18th century, it then just got folded in with Byzantium as this kind of Oriental despotism, retrograde, whatever. And then the Soviet Union kind of amplified all of that. And it was terrible that, I mean, I know what Obolensky was doing in the Byzantine Commonwealth, where he was linking all of these things. Fair enough. Like, he's describing an actual world that existed. But then it just became this thing that really, really distorted how we see this world. And so I'm looking for like alternative or additional commonwealths. Garth Foden wrote about another one that was earlier and included the
Yeah.
Caucasus and so on. And he kind of gestured, in this is in his Empire to Commonwealth, toward the material that you're working on here. But I was
Yeah.
so happy to see it put together in this way. You've done us all a real service. I mean, you and what, 40 whatever other people
The
and
40 contributors
40
and
contributors, and the advisory council
yeah.
has how many?
The advisory council had 15, then the community advisory council had 40 total. So it was,
And you coordinated all of that?
yeah, coordinated. I've learned so many things through the development of this exhibition that I didn't think I would learn when I was getting my PhD in Byzantine art.
Wow, that is an enormous, that's like running an aircraft carrier or something. That is, wow. Actually, I am interested in the logistics of these exhibitions. Being a little bit of a bureaucrat myself. And a couple questions that I have. Can you tell us a little bit about the securing access to the objects? I mean, like, is that more difficult, easier, or I mean, are there unusual difficulties in securing these permissions, or can you tell us any stories about that? This must be a very involved process.
Absolutely. So originally, we were planning to borrow from Tunisia, Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. So in 2018, those are materials that were on our checklist. Then we obviously had works of art from all of these regions within the exhibition, but we ended up only being able to borrow from institutions in Tunisia and Egypt and Sinai as well because of all the things that have been happening in the world since 2018. And we had COVID, but then there's also civil unrest in Sudan and both and Ethiopia as well. But then it also became a capacity issue in terms of negotiating with specific governments. Like the time that it took to negotiate with Tunisia, for example, about the logistics of shipping and packing and then different loan agreements. I mean, that was just, it took a lot of time, right? And to do that for each country in terms of not only me, but then our councils and office and different colleagues and different 2 a.m. conversations because of the time difference, it was a lot. And so one thing that I really wanted to do also for this exhibition was to develop sustainable collaborations with the colleagues in these institutions. And so in thinking about what our conversations look like beyond the scope of this, 3, 9 month exhibition both at Cleveland and at the Met. And so I really tried to cultivate that as well. And that also took a lot of time. And so it was, in terms of your question, in terms of complications, it was a lot, right? But the great thing, so even though we didn't get loans from Sudan, for example, we are now hosting curators from Sudan here at the Met from that same institution because we couldn't get those loans for very practical reasons. Like we didn't know that we would be able to return the objects from the Khartoum Museum on a certain date. Any object that comes into an exhibition, you have to return it, right? But because of the unrest in the region, we couldn't tell our State Department on July 15th, these objects are going back to the National Museum in Khartoum. Like it was just not something our lawyers could sign off on. And so that's one of the reasons why we didn't bring the objects into the show. But I saw this as an opportunity to continue the conversations with our colleagues there. And so that's why we were able to bring them to the Met and think about what's sustainable partnerships long term. And for our 2035 exhibition, right? When we have these new terms, like we've already have these relationships, and hopefully those negotiations will be a little bit easier then.
Right. I wasn't even thinking about that. Yeah, you're also planning for the future too. I smiled because I remembered, so in the 90s again, it was, I met Helen or Solanka. I can't remember now, but I remember a conversation where it was all about the insurance contracts.
Yeah, absolutely.
I, of course, at the time I was a grad student, I had never thought of insurance contracts, but this is like kept them up at night and reading all of these documents. Anyway.
No, absolutely insurance. But then also, these objects are under the care of really wonderful colleagues. Like Sinai, for example. When I went to Sinai with Helen, actually, the monks asked me if I climbed Sinai before. Like so I was about to do my presentation about the exhibition. And the first question was like, okay, that this Africa Byzantium idea is interesting, but have you climbed Sinai yet? And I said, I hadn't. I said, no, maybe next time. And they said, no, we're not going to have this conversation with you about your project until you climb Sinai. And I was thinking to myself, well, maybe it's not that hard, right, to do because they wouldn't necessarily ask this from of me to do right now and then have the conversation if it was really difficult. It took me 7 hours to go up and then go down. It was fantastic, by the way. By the time I got up, I was like, okay, I understand what it means to climb Sinai and why they're asking us to do that before I had a conversation about the icons that are so important to the monastic community. But like, I mean, each object in the exhibition was a result of a conversation kind of like this. I didn't climb big mountains for every single object, but it felt like
Yeah.
It did feel like I had to move mountains for some loan negotiations, and but I'm really proud of what we were able to bring into the exhibition. Not only the objects, but the different the voices, the communities, the scholarships, and it was such a great experience.
Well, you were being tested, right?
Absolutely, I felt the aesthetic experience.
Yes. Actually, I have a funny story. It was told by a colleague who went to Assos to see a manuscript in order to, edit a text. And I'll make it very short. So they had made a prior appointment with the librarian of the monastery to be given this manuscript. There were two scholars, and one is a very good friend of mine. And they went and they were introduced and they met him. And the guy said nothing about manuscripts or the library or having access. You just stay there. And one day passed and another day passed. And they would see the guy, the librarian monk, and he would come into the various, rooms and greet them, whatever, and say nothing, right? And then, like, on the third day, a monk just showed up at their room and gave them the manuscript and said, okay, you can work on it now. And they were like, what is going on? Later, they figured out that essentially they were being tested as to whether they were patient or whether they would just start complaining about, like, we made a this appointment and where's the manuscript? And just to
Oh
see
my
if you had
gosh.
the virtues of, I don't know.
No, that's such an amazing story. And I mean, I think this is something that they have to do. Felt like these tests, like I think that because they are the caretakers of this material that has like such long antiquity,
Yes.
right? And
Yes.
they've protected this material for thousands of years. Like and so I appreciate that actually.
Yeah, I'd rather climb Mount Sinai. Because I don't know that I would have the patience. Hey, we had a day, right? I mean, what's
No.
yeah. Can you tell our audience where and when they can see this exhibition and any final thoughts that you have?
So now it's at the Cleveland Museum of Art from today. It opened last week. So today's April 15th to July, mid-July. And the installation at Cleveland is so beautiful. They have much more space than the Met's installation. And so it was really lovely to be able to see the objects breathe a little bit more because our space at the Met has 7,000 square feet and the Cleveland Museum of Art has 10,000 square feet and beautiful high ceilings. And even if you've been to the Met installation, please go to Cleveland and see these objects again. There's some works of art in this exhibition that I would know that I would never probably be able to see again. And so it's such a monumental opportunity to spend time with them.
And you'll be there on May 1st. Are you giving a talk or?
No, I'm just there to hang out. But if you see me in the
Okay.
galleries, come
All
say
right.
hi. Yeah.
Okay. Andrea, you've done us all a tremendous service here, so I wanted to thank you. And I think I'm gonna take a student. We go out to Cleveland and say I don't know when though, but scheduled anyway. Until when did you say it would be there?
From April to mid-July. I think July
Oh,
14th or
okay.
so. Yeah.
All right. Well, Andrea, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for coming on, and I hope to see you at the Byzantine Studies Conference or wherever.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Take care.